Hello, podcast listeners. Just a quick notice that in our next recording session, which is on March 10, myself and Rhiannon will be recording a Q&A episode. So if you have any cues that you'd like to be aid, whether it be about the podcast, our process, something that we've said, something that we haven't said, then go to the Emperors of Rome Facebook page and there'll be a pinned topic there. We'll select some and give you the answers you potentially desire. And now... Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I would be your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XLIV, Roman Sexuality, in which we explore the ins and outs, no sniggering over there, of what the Romans thought about sex and the role that marriage played in the Roman society. This podcast is a listener request from Greg Cremian, from Washington, D.C. in the United States. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
The Roman system, if you want to call it that, of sexuality was quite different to ours. And one of the things you might think about with regard to the Romans is that they were always engaged in orgies, because that's what happens in films. And there's a certain amount of truth in that the Romans weren't as uptight about adultery in some ways as we might be. But basically, this was something that was quite patriarchal, in that if you were a married man, you didn't necessarily have to be chaste. Nobody would look down on you if you had sex with other women outside of your marriage. All right, so you're married and you're married in order to have legitimate children, but you might be having sex with slaves of either sex or indeed people who weren't of high status. The only real kind of bugbear that the Romans would have about this is you shouldn't be having sex with other respectable married women or other respectable women, because that would actually have some effect on somebody else's marriage. Am I not being very clear? You look confused about this. Is this a bad start?
The reason why I give you a confused look is because you say that, you know, we've kind of got a misconception about how hard and fast things were in ancient Rome, but that kind of sounds exactly like the conception that we've got of it. That's how we think of it, that anyone's kind of fair game.
Well, it's not true that anyone's fair game, because if you're a respectable married woman, you're not fair game.
Yeah, but that, okay, so besides them.
That's a big group.
Well, okay. But besides that big group, you could go and have sex with somebody else and society goes, yeah, fine, that's fine.
You as a male Roman citizen.
Sure.
Because we always look from their point of view. Yes, it's not a big deal. But it is more complicated than that, in that if you are obsessed with sex, then that might be seen as being out of control. So it's actually not okay to just indulge in every kind of sexual practice, because there are moral issues with it. It's just they don't overlap absolutely with our moral issues. Mm. So, for example, people, and we've talked about some of them because some of them were emperors, people like Nero can be criticized for their sexual practices. It comes down to a feeling that he can't control himself. All right. So it's not the fact of having sex with people who aren't his wife that is exactly a problem, as it might be for a contemporary politician. It's the fact that he doesn't seem to have any kind of limit to the way that he practices sex. So, for example, when he castrated one of his freedmen and then married him, now describing her as her, and when he got, you know, he married somebody else in the guise of a bride, he just doesn't put any limits on his gender role and his sexual practice. All right. And it's not just the role, it's also the amount of sex. So while technically it's okay to have sex with people outside your marriage if you're a male Roman citizen, if you're doing that all the time, there's an idea that you don't have any bodily restraint. And that means that you're not the kind of person who can be in control, who can have power over other Romans, or you really shouldn't. So there actually are moral issues about sexual practices for the Romans. In some ways they're quite conservative, not in the same ways that we might be.
But that sounds a bit more about to do with excesses and probably applies to excesses in general. You know, like if you were too preoccupied with trying to be a gladiator instead of worrying about issues of state, then the Romans would have a problem with that.
They certainly would, because yes. That involves status as well. But you're quite right, and it quite often is to do with appetites.
Yeah.
So if you eat too much, if you're a glutton, you can't control your body. If you really desperately want to appear on stage or be a gladiator, then you haven't controlled the role that you should be portraying as an in-control Roman male citizen, then that's wrong. You're right. It's not the same kind of, and it's very difficult, I think, for us to get into that mindset. And it's because in the West, we've had so many centuries of Christian morality. There's a lot of issues of morality surrounding marriage and sexuality for us. We have to try and clear that away when we think about how the Romans thought of it, but it's almost impossible for us.
So I don't want to infer that it was a public event, but was sex a lot more out in the open in Roman times?
That's quite difficult for us to say. The most famous example of this, and the one that people might be familiar with, is that there's what we would call pornography painted on walls of people's houses in Pompeii. So there's people engaging in sex acts, apparently decorating your dining room.
And in the public baths as well. Yeah. There's the thought that they were coat rack kind of holders.
I mean, this isn't quite as directly connected, but for us it would still look sexual, and it has a connection with it. The god Priapus, who's a hyperphallic god and who's the god of fertility and gardens, there are lots of little kind of effigies of him being hyperphallic on lamps, on mosaics to protect doorways. There are little statues in gardens because he protects the garden by threatening to rape people. He's everywhere. You know, we look at those, it's very hard not to laugh.
Yeah.
I took a photo, of course, because it just seems ridiculous that he's almost overbalanced by his penis.
Yeah.
But for them, it's everywhere around them. Clearly, it's, you know, it's decorating lamps, everyday items.
Mm.
They're much more comfortable with the body that's naked and sexualized in that sense. So we can't equate every scene we see of a naked body or even a sex scene with something that's meant to be prurient, something that's meant to kind of get you going. Because it was thought at one point that every one of those paintings of a sex scene in Pompeii was in a brothel, which would kind of fit with our conception of where we might find them. But then it was calculated that there'd have to be a brothel for every other person in Pompeii or something like that, because there were so many of these scenes, and that just didn't work. You know, you wouldn't be able to have buildings for anything else. So that does indicate a very different relationship with sex and the portrayal of sex than the one that we have. You're quite right. We tend to see it as something that's much more covered up.
So in that case, what was marriage like in Roman times? Very different from ours.
It is, but it is in some ways quite similar, in that it is certainly, for Australia, it's still a marriage between a man and a woman, and it's monogamous, at least at one particular time, so you don't marry more than one person at a time. It's in some ways quite simple, though, so you don't have a particular ceremony that you have to go through, whereas we have certain words that have to be said at a ceremony to make it legal. For them, it's much more, you know, I take you, and that's it. It is usually something, certainly if you're of any status, it's something organized between the bride's father and the groom, or possibly the groom's father. It would have involved a dowry. The dowry goes to the husband, but it actually is meant to be kept and given back if there's a divorce.
Right, okay.
All right, so the husband can sort of use that money, make money out of it, presumably, but he's meant to be able to give it back unless there are grounds for divorce, like adultery. Then it can be fought. So it is something that can end up in the courts, but there's nothing in particular that has to be said to make it a marriage. It's an agreement between the woman's father and the groom. And it would have involved, at the very basic level, literal handing over. In Latin, the phrase is, I lead you home. That means I get married.
Yeah.
All right. So the woman gets led home. There are actually different verbs for whether you're getting married as a man or getting married as a woman. So you can lead a woman home. The woman doesn't use that verb. She gets led home. So it's a kind of transferal of her from her father's house, whoever is the male who's in charge of her household, into her husband's house. She doesn't change her name usually, although in early forms of marriage, it does seem that the husband became her kind of new guardian.
Mm.
by the time we've got many historical records, technically she still stays under the auspices or the control of her own father. She moves out of her own household, but she's not really under the legal control of her husband. She's always technically part of her own family because Roman women's names were basically their father's name in a feminized form, and that doesn't change. So that's a little bit different to what we might practice in the modern West. One thing that is different, at least until recently here, is that divorce is very, very common and very, very easy. If you think about the 19th century in Europe and the westernized world, it's really shameful to get divorced. The woman's sort of left in limbo. Usually, you know, they might find it difficult to marry again. That's not the case for Roman women. In fact, especially if you're an aristocratic woman, you might be married off and divorced several times because you might be part of your family's power play. We need to get in with that family now, so we're going to get you to divorce your husband and marry this guy. So the famous instance of when that goes on is when Julius Caesar marries his daughter to Pompey, who's much, much older than her. He's older than Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
That's also quite common to be married to someone a fair bit older. And say in the family of Augustus, he marries off his daughter, who's also called Julia, three times. And it's all about who he's designating as his heir, who he wants to hand over power to. And that's very common in Republican families in particular, that the daughters will be part of that power play. So that's what marriage is for. So we certainly shouldn't see marriage typically as a romantic affair.
So is there a concept of adultery there? You said that you can't have, well, you shouldn't have relations with another aristocrat's wife. But besides that, can aristocratic women have sex outside the marriage, for example? Is it, you know, you can have sex with other people?
It's frowned upon, and it's the kind of thing that Cicero might bring up in his speeches as
lovely.
as something that makes you bereft of morals.
Yes.
Basically, it's okay for men, but not for women.
Right.
There is a definite double standard there. But it's much worse for women if they're married. And this, although it's not really acknowledged by Roman texts, but it does come back to the legitimacy of the offspring, which is very, very important for the Romans, that the father has to acknowledge the child as his to make it legal at all. You know, there were rumors, for example, that Julius Caesar was actually the father of Brutus, the man who murdered him, because he had had an affair with Brutus's mother.
Mm. I seem to remember, like, in Suetonius, that it was also dragged up to kind of discredit people as well.
Yeah.
So Domitian's wife having an affair with Titus, Agrippina getting around a bit, making a pass at, oh, wow, I'm trying to remember here, Galba when he was younger.
It starts to get suspicious because it's usually the emperor's wife having had supposedly an affair or trying to have an affair with someone who later becomes emperor. There's this idea that there's this kind of sexual disease amongst the imperial family. And I think quite often writers are trying to indicate that there's some kind of misuse of power going on, or they're not happy with the way that the imperial family is manipulating. Like with Agrippina, then the writers aren't happy with the way that she maneuvers her son into becoming the next emperor. It's her son, not Claudius's son. There is a sense that often authors will use sexual immorality to talk about other political issues that are going on, especially when women seem to have more of a say than perhaps patriarchal writers would be completely happy with. Agrippina gets it in the neck from Suetonius and from Tacitus, probably for those reasons.
All right, so if we could talk about homosexuality, the impression that I have come away with is that it was a lot more accepted, a lot more a part of normality in ancient Rome.
It's partly true in that sex between men and younger men, particularly boys, we would regard them as, is not frowned upon. Certainly lesbianism is never talked about, barely exists for them. It's referred to in a very few texts, and I have to say the authors seem very confused. Actually, a lot of people have a problem with designating it homosexuality. So there's a lot of scholarly discussion about this, partly because homosexual for us also has associations of a particular lifestyle or an identity. So the idea is that generally that the Romans, a Roman man, didn't kind of invest an identity in being heterosexual or homosexual. They didn't talk about themselves as being one or the other. They didn't have those words.
Mm.
Right? There's a famous book, which is actually about ancient Greece, called 100 Years of Homosexuality, which was published in the 1990s, because that was the point at which it was 100 years since that term had first been used. All right, so it didn't exist, even though it's a word that's from a Greek word, homo meaning same, and sexus meaning sex in Latin. So it's a word that actually combines Greek and Latin, which classicists have a problem with anyway.
Yep.
Even though it's a word with classical roots, it's not used in antiquity. And one of the things that that indicates is that they didn't invest their identity in who they had sex with. But having gone through, trawled through all of that as a caveat,
yes,
something you should bear in mind, we should say that for a Roman man, having sex with younger men, and again, it's about who they are. They should be of lower status in some way. So slave boys, for example, are absolutely fair game for a freeborn Roman male. That's not considered morally reprobate. It's not really something for particular comment. But that doesn't mean there's not a problem around this, because if you think back to Julius Caesar, for example, in Suetonius, one of the accusations that's made against Caesar is that he has been the boy love of King Nicomedes, right, of an Eastern king.
I do remember that, yeah. Yeah.
So to have been in that position puts you in a lesser position.
Seen as a submissive kind of...
Yeah, exactly. Thing. So it's about status. Mm. If Caesar had sex with boy slaves, nobody really cares. But if he is the one who's lower in that status map, if you like, then that's a problem. Although to a degree, it's only a problem in that his enemies use it against him. We've no idea whether it's true or not. But it's also something that, as Suetonius also relates, could be used in a kind of a fun way. So it could be brought up in speeches where people are having a go at Caesar in the Senate. But it's also something that his soldiers used in kind of ribald songs, saying that, you know, once he was the boy love of Nicomedes and now he's doing it to the Gauls. In that kind of, Julius Caesar seems to have been one of the people who could kind of take it as well as he could put it out there,
yeah,
in terms of,
yeah,
insults. He doesn't seem to have been particularly bothered by it. So there is a degree to which it's sort of boys together ribbing each other,
yeah,
going on.
Yeah.
But if it came down to it, if Julius Caesar was on trial, they might bring out, I mean, you know, there's this mark over his sexual morality. He's been someone who's been in this passive position, as they might see it. What does that indicate about his ability to act as a free Roman man, as a general, as an imperator? So there is a little bit of unease about certain roles within what we might regard as a homosexual relationship. And in very broad strokes, this is often put down to the idea that the Roman man should always be the active participant in anything he does, including in sex. So if you're having sex with a woman, the idea is that's fine. You know, that's, the man is always the active participant in the Roman mind in sex with a woman. With a man or a boy, you know, there could be a bit of haziness there because basically there are two penises involved. So that's potentially a problem. But it's about status. It's not about sex between two males.
But Suetonius, who famously likes to drag out the sort of details of anything, dwelled in this with Nero and Caligula and Domitian, who we believe are bad emperors.
Well, they have that reputation of being bad emperors, and you're absolutely right to make that connection, because that is one of the ways that a biographer, that a writer like Suetonius, can paint these emperors exactly as that, as mad or bad or deluded. And Caligula and Nero in particular are associated with what he describes as deviant sexuality. And with Domitian, it's more, you know, incest, sex with his niece, and kind of rampant sexuality, which comes back to that idea I talked about before, where it's this lack of self-control. That's why it's quite hard for ancient historians to know whether these stories can be verified or not, because they're the kind of stories that are used against emperors who you want to paint as bad. All three of them come to a bad end. All right, so they're unpopular emperors, the emperors who are painted badly by their successors. So there's this sort of easy way that their faults in the Roman sense of morality might be painted up, whereas others might be played down.
Mm. Do you believe that there's an issue then holding Romans up to modern day sexual norms?
Well, yes, you can't do it. Everything they did almost is horrific. All right. So there's no legal protection for slaves, any slave. The master or mistress can do what they like with them sexually, physically in any way. their property. That's a huge problem for us, and it should be. We would also have a problem with what we would call paedophilia, which is widely practiced in antiquity generally, not just by the Romans. All right, but it's impossible for us to regard that as acceptable. And that's one of the ways that it's very difficult for us to get into the Roman mindset. They would find it very hard to see why we had laws about it. Because it's not about the age of the person for them, it's about their status in society. So if they're a free-born Roman male who hasn't obtained adulthood, yes, that's a crime. It's awful, it's terrible, it's something they'd be disgusted by. But if they're a slave or even a foreigner, someone who's never going to be a citizen, it's just not an issue for them. We can't hold them to our standards because then we would just regard them as people who are beyond the pale and we can't study them. But it's really, really difficult at times, and it's quite a hard subject to discuss for those reasons. But in a way, I think that's why we should discuss it, because we can see that these things, they're not necessarily normalized. There is a history, as Foucault called it, a history of sexuality. Things have been different, and it's quite important for us to see how we got to where we are and why we have the particular moral codes that we have. You know, it's not something we can assume and take for granted.
It's also interesting that a lot of the rules that we developed around sexuality have now fallen away. Homosexuality used to be a crime.
Well, yeah, and this is part of what I mean by these rules, these so-called social and in some case legal rules change over time. And you're right, it's not that long ago that certain things were criminalized or certainly looked down on, which we now regard as perfectly normal and something that we embrace as part of our society. And perhaps that's a reason to look at antiquity, because there is this continuum. Not that, and I think anyone these days would say, well, the Romans did this, therefore it's acceptable. That's nonsense. But to look at these issues and to see that things do change over time, and we can anticipate that for us, our mores will change. And we have to think about whether that's acceptable, what we want to be acceptable, and what the reasons for that are. So it fits into a history, and it is a social history that's really important.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. We would love it if you leave a review there, because reviews help others find this podcast. Emperors of Rome has a Facebook page which you can go and like, and you can follow myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Trajan. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.